Okay, so the first Zionist Congress takes place at the casino in Basel, in Switzerland, late August 1897. It's a three-day affair. Officially, there are 194 delegates, but there were probably twice that many number of Jews present because plenty of people were in the gallery or were not registered as delegates. Bear in mind that this was an organization that doesn't really exist yet. This is a Congress that's going to form a more permanent organization, so there were no real bylaws indicating who was entitled to be there. It was basically just if Herzl sent you an invitation, you were a delegate, and that was that. Although certain people were representing official Zionist bodies that existed in other countries, like in Russia, America, and elsewhere. Okay, so it's a very momentous occasion. Herzl wants this to be with theatrics and formality. He wants people to wear top coats and fancy attire, not to come look like a schnorrer or a schlamazel. You have to come in a tuxedo. And he yells at people and sort of browbeats them into doing his bidding that this should be a regal event with him at the forefront. So the most important speech of that event was by Max Nordau. Max Nordau is Herzl's number two guy. He's a Western European Jew who's married to a non-Jew, which is an issue, and he's an atheist. He's the only famous person in the audience. Everyone else was famous by, like, Jewish famous. He was the only one who was legitimately, like, European famous. He was an author of renown. And his participation was to give a drasha, give a sermon about the state of world Jewish affairs, going country by country, seeing how bad is anti-Semitism, what is the situation of the persecution of the Jews. It was a tour de force on the state of world Jewry. But people didn't come to hear Nordau, they came to hear Herzl. And he was underwhelming by comparison, but that's okay. They cheered his every sentence. There was a round of applause every minute, like a State of the Union address. Okay, yeah.
What language did he speak?
German. Everything was in German. All the Zionist congresses were in German until after World War I, when then they switched to partly Hebrew and still some German and some Yiddish. But at this point,
no English yet.
No.
The Americans weren't at that.
The Americans were mostly Germans. Interestingly, because even though American German Jews tended to be anti-Zionist, the few major representatives they had at that time were, like, recently off the boat Central European Jews who spoke a fluent German. Okay. There was a big question in the first Zionist Congress about whether or not to be explicit in the desires of the movement, that the Basel program was going to call for the renaissance of Jewish national life in Eretz Yisrael, but was the issue of statehood as secured by international law going to be mentioned or not? There were those who feared that if you grab too much in the platform, tafasta maruba, lo tafasta, you grab too much, you grab nothing, that it'll backfire, that the Turks will cause problems for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael and will prevent immigration going forward if they think that the Zionists are trying to grab statehood in the here and now. On the other hand, there were those who said, well, if we can't be honest amongst ourselves, what's the whole point of the movement? We have to be clear about what our goals are. We shouldn't have ambiguity. And consequences be damned. In the end, the Basel program is fairly explicit about the desire for a Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Herzl recognizes that he has to walk on eggshells. He has to not offend a wide range of groups. And I ended last time with a citation from his diary about all the parties that he has to worry about. So first he has to worry about the Orthodox. So he takes care of that by going to shul on Shabbos before the Congress. He hadn't been to a shul in years. And he got an aliyah. And he said he was more nervous about the brachas for that aliyah than he was about the whole Congress. But he had someone feeding him the words on the side. So he did okay. So he has to worry about the Orthodox. He has to worry about the anti-Orthodox, in other words, the secularists, who are afraid that Jewish nationalism will become a theocracy. And he has to safeguard against anyone thinking that, because that's not what he has in mind. Yeah, okay. It's true. So then he has to worry about not offending the Turks, because if he's too aggressive in seeking sovereignty, the Turks can shut things down. He has to worry about not offending the Tsar, because the Tsar can make things worse for the Jews of Russia and prohibit Zionist agitation in Russia if he doesn't like what he sees. And there are Russian spies in the room. He has to worry about the fact that he's an Austrian citizen and is a subject of the Habsburg monarch. And he can't do anything that's going to cast dispersions on the Habsburg monarch. He has to worry about the fact that he's employed by the New Free Press, and Benedict and Bacher, the publishers, are avowedly anti-Zionist. And he doesn't want to get fired because he needs Parnassa. And he doesn't want to take a penny for his Zionist activities. He wants to earn his own living and do this as a sideshow for free. He has to worry about not offending Edmund Rothschild, who's paying for all the Yeshuvim in Eretz Yisrael. He has to worry about not offending the Jews of Eretz Yisrael by belittling them, because his whole idea is diplomacy was what matters and not facts on the ground. And they are the facts on the ground, and he is effectively belittling them. So all these things are in the air as he's conducting the Congress. In the end, it's a big success. There hadn't been something like this in 2,000 years, and Herzl's now the Mashiach. So when it's over, he recognizes that he had a major accomplishment. And in his diary he writes, "At Basel, I founded the Jewish state." People will laugh at me if they hear this now, but in 50 years they'll know that I was right. And 51 years later, there's a state of Israel. So he was very prescient in his prediction that 50 years, a half a century. Now, what did he mean by "At Basel, I founded the Jewish state"? And in what way was he actually correct? The answer is that the framework of the World Zionist Organization was established at that Congress, and it continued basically unchanged all the way until the establishment of the state. That there is a direct line between Herzl on the Presidium to Wolfson to Weizmann to Sokolow back to Weizmann to Ben-Gurion. That the same organization and executive committee and its parliamentary aspect, the Congress, existed for 51 years leading up to statehood. He really did establish these institutions, yeah.
What authority did he anticipate? This was all before the UN, of course, that got formed after the war.
Uh-huh.
What governing authority would empower an entity to become a state?
Okay, good. So we're in colonial times. I don't mean like Williamsburg, Virginia, but colonial times in the sense of, in Europe, colonialism is still kosher. This is not the, you know, post-World War II where colonialism is evil, and anyone who uses that term is now a reactionary. So what are you going to rely upon? The great world powers, the colonial powers, if they support this Jewish national movement, then their for a force of arms, but Herzl doesn't want it to be by force of arms, he wants it to be peaceful, their say-so makes it legitimate in the diplomatic sphere. So tonight we're going to discuss which world powers does Herzl turn to in the hopes of securing for Zionism international legitimacy. He'll turn in sequence to the Germans, to the Turks themselves, to the Russians, to the Catholics, and to the Italians. When I say the Catholics, I mean the Pope. Okay. And along the way, the British. But the British are an exception because it's a little quirk. So, in 1898, Herzl needs a victory. He needs some kind of diplomatic achievement to go back to his parliament and be able to say that this movement is going somewhere. Because in 1897, it's all smoke and mirrors. He's got nothing. He's got just 200 Jews or 300 Jews gathering in a room in Switzerland. But there's no money behind it. There's no diplomacy behind it. It's nothing. It's a fake. It's a bluff. He's a charlatan, potentially. Unless he proves that he has some kind of success. Well, financially, he has not been able to win over the moneyed elite. So how did they have any money? Herzl spent a lot of his own money, his father's money, his wife's dowry, but he needs cash. So the shekel, the dues-paying Zionists all give the shekel, and that entitles them to a vote for parliamentary representation in future congresses. That's going to be his money supply, which is controlled by the Zionist executive, which he's in charge of. So he has a little bit of money, but not much. He needs diplomatic success. He turns to the Germans. He wants a meeting with Kaiser Wilhelm II. And he thinks that there is a logical basis for the Kaiser to support Zionism. Well, how does he get access to the Kaiser? So last time I mentioned that Herzl had a few agents who worked for him. One was the Anglican chaplain at the British Embassy in Vienna, William Hechler, who was a millennialist and believed in the Jewish return to Zion in the year 1897 or 1898, and so he had access to the Grand Duke of Baden, who was the uncle of the Kaiser, and so somebody knows somebody who knows somebody, and you can get a meeting with the Kaiser, maybe. The other was Philip Michael Nevlinsky, who had connections in Turkey and Constantinople, and the third was Arminius Vambery, who was actually originally born a Hungarian Jew, who then converted to Islam, Lutheranism, Catholicism, and other forms of Protestantism along the way. He was a minister in two different religions, and then became an atheist and died in 1913. But he was like a shyster who dabbled in diplomacy, but that was okay at the time. Unlike today, when it's looked down upon to be an independent operator in the realm of international affairs, back then that was considered totally kosher. So Herzl had these weird characters whom he paid a pretty penny to do his bidding for him to gain him access to the halls of power. So he got access to the Kaiser through the foreign minister and through the chief of staff. Well, Herzl met the Kaiser three times. Three times. The first was in Constantinople, when the Kaiser was on his pilgrimage to the Near East. And that went reasonably well. Then the Kaiser went to Israel, to Palestine, and Herzl followed him. And Herzl met the Kaiser while he's riding on horseback right near the gate to Mikveh Israel Agricultural School. There's a very famous photograph of Herzl standing and the Kaiser on horseback and them shaking hands. And they had about a five-minute impromptu meeting right there. The third was in Jerusalem. Well, actually, just outside the old city on Mount Scopus. There was a tent encampment, a royal encampment for the Kaiser, where he stayed for a week while he was on his pilgrimage to the holy places, and Herzl met him there.
Did the Kaiser have any relationship to the German colony that's in Jerusalem, the Adlion is there?
Yeah. I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a new hotel right there on Emekofayim of the Orient.
Because it happened simultaneous. That colony comes from the 1890s, and he was there, and he met with them. He visited them. Yeah. So, the first two meetings went well. The third one didn't go well. What Herzl thought was that the Kaiser will like Zionism because it will alleviate the pressure of excess Jews in Germany. That the Kaiser is an anti-Semite. A benign one at that, but an anti-Semite nonetheless. And anything that will get Jews out of his country, in a non-violent way, will be a good thing. Also, if there will be a German protectorate in Palestine, in which Jews can live in freedom among their own kind, well, that gives Germany a toehold in the Middle East, which I'm sure they would very much want, and was the reason for his trip in the first place. Although ostensibly he was a Christian pilgrim, the real reason was he wanted to negotiate terms for a railroad to Baghdad. So there's always a money angle and a political angle, and giving the Germans a toehold in the Middle East was a good thing for the Germans in theory. Also, it helps prop up the Ottoman Empire, and the Germans want to see the Ottoman Empire survive. They don't want to see it decline. Also, it would be a historic act for the Kaiser, who regarded himself as the wisest of all sovereigns. He thought he was the greatest head of state in the world. The truth is, he was a yutz. He was a nobody. He was a dummy. I don't say he was wicked. I don't say he was along the lines of the bad guys of World War II. But he was a nothing, and his career ended kind of ignominiously. So the last factor was.
You know, the proof of the point about that was
that he was still around when the Germans invaded Belgium. Right, he died in 1941.
And nobody cared.
He was a nothing. So the British and the French also wanted to put their tentacles into the Middle East. And if the Jews were to go under German patronage in a still tottering Ottoman Empire, the Jews represent German Kultur. After all, the Jews are really Germans. Is that true? It is. Yes, it is true. The Jews are Germans by culture. All sophisticated German European Jews were enamored with Germany. Even the Jews in Russia were enamored with Germany. So Herzl was going to convince Wilhelm, if you plop us down in Palestine, we will be an outpost of Germanism in the Middle East. Okay. Well, why did this all fail? The answer is that we don't know the answer. It could be 1,001 reasons. But it's important to recognize what really was happening here. A Kaiser, a head of state, meets many, many people every day, every week, every month, every year, each one with some kind of a political agenda, with an idea, an ism. And even if the head of state likes a certain ism, let's call it Zionism, it could be a passing fancy. It could be that today he likes it, and tomorrow he likes it, and a week from now he forgot that it ever existed. So, while for the moment Zionism might have made a little bit of sense, at some point the Kaiser just decides, I'm not interested in this. He's walking away. A reason could be that he envisioned that the Ottomans would not be willing to play ball, that the Ottomans were not interested in giving territory over to the Jews, not even with just a minor concession of rights, but rather they're going to hold firm. Plus, there are the holy places to take into consideration, and nobody wants to give holy places to the Jews. So the Kaiser was a potential ally, but fizzled out. The Kaiser fizzles out. Well, if not Germany, then to whom is Herzl going to turn for a diplomatic success in the realm of Zionism? The answer is he thinks about the Tsar. Let's turn to the Tsar. And he asks the Kaiser or the Kaiser's underlings to see if the Tsar, who is the Kaiser's cousin, would be interested in being a patron of Zionism. The logic being that Zionism and anti-Semitism go hand in hand. If you don't like Jews, this is a good place to send them, off to Eretz Yisrael. Well, that also went nowhere in 1898. So Herzl has to go back to Basel for the Second Congress without much to show for. He had met a head of state, he had met the Kaiser a few times, but there's no real progress. So there was a big question, should there be a Second Zionist Congress 1 year after the first? Is that too soon? What do you think? How often is there a Republican National Convention? Every presidential year, every 4 years. So do you have to have a big sound and light show every year? It may be too frequent. Plus, travel was very difficult in 1898. This is not 2019. There's no airplanes. So to gather the gang back in Switzerland every 12 months may be a bit much. But Herzl says, do it anyway. Why? Because at this point, all they have is the sound and light show. And if you don't even have that, then you have nothing. So we have to have this big shebang, even if we can't say anything substantive, because at least getting together and talking is better than nothing. Plus, he's able to say, I met a head of state, and we had some progress in terms of growing the ranks of the roster of the shekel payers. We have more money in the bank. There are some petty little successes that he could point to, even if no major success. Well, one important thing to realize, Herzl's trip to Israel in 1898 was his only trip to Israel, ever. And of course, he doesn't live very long. He dies at the age of 44. Had he lived longer, he probably would have gone more times. But this was his only trip to Eretz Yisrael, and he only went because the Kaiser was going to be there. So there's a certain irony that Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, was only in Israel one time, and only because the German head of state happened to be there. Just a little anecdotal detail. Yeah. Okay, so when Herzl got to Israel, what happened? He was afraid that the Turks wouldn't even let him in the country, because they knew what he was up to. So it took German officers to push Herzl through the gatekeepers at Jaffa, that for a week, basically, the Ottoman regime disappeared, and the Germans took over the whole country. And they were able to thrust Herzl through the border control. Herzl twisted his ankle while getting off the boat. Why? because Jaffa had no real harbor at that time. All large vessels had to park 50 yards out, and you had to take a little vessel, like a little pedal boat, to the shore. And then he took a misstep, as it happens to people, you know, when they go off these little boats, and he twisted his ankle. So he's annoyed. He comes to Eretz Yisrael with mixed feelings. Mixed feelings. He's not sure what's going to happen here. He's also afraid of being assassinated. For one of only two times in his life, he fears for assassination. Who wants to kill him, potentially? Well, the Turks might want to kill him. The Arabs might want to kill him. Some disgruntled Jews might want to kill him. You never know. But there were some credible threats against his life, and so he's a little nervous. He's only there for about 11 days. And while he's there, he goes to see all the yeshuvim, all the settlements that have been funded by Rothschild and the few that were not funded by Rothschild, and he's very well received. So on that front, things are good. He was poo-pooing the significance of these settlements, but he went there and he was a hero. But then it was time to go to Yerushalayim, and it was Friday, and he took the train, and the train was very slow in those years. It was a four-hour trip for a 50-mile ride. And it was Shabbos by the time that they got to Yerushalayim. Now, remember, where was the railroad station? The Tachana Rishona. Where is that?
German.
Okay, good. So how far is that from the old city? Walking. It's a walk. It's a 20-minute, half-hour walk. Remember, they didn't have the Mamila Mall back then, so you had to actually walk up the hill, you know, not like we have today. So he wanted to take a taxi, a horse-drawn carriage. Because his foot was hurting him. It's late, he's tired, he has a fever, he later got malaria. But they say to him, you know, it's Shabbos. If we take the taxi, the Orthodox are going to stone us to death. So they had to walk the last half hour to the old city, lugging the suitcases, and I'm sure there was no Eruv in those years, because of concern for the religious. So that's just to give you a flavor of what his trip was like the one time he went to Eretz Yisrael. Good. In 1899 and 1900, there really isn't much diplomatic success. And Herzl's focus is the Jewish Colonial Trust. He wants a bank to fund Zionist activities in Eretz Yisrael and the diplomatic activities in the abroad. The problem is none of the Jewish bankers are willing to be the underwriters of this Jewish Colonial Trust. He's not getting big donations. He's going to have to rely upon small donations, and eventually they're able to establish it. So it does come into existence, and then later you have the Keren HaKayemet in 1901. Finances, that's his focus for about 2 years. But he needs some diplomatic action. So the next direction is to go to the Sultan. Try to cut a deal with the Sultan. Sultan Abdul Hamid II. And he uses his various agents, these nefarious agents, Nevlinsky and Vambery, to get access again to the Sultan's henchmen. And in 1901, he gets a meeting with the Sultan. What is this meeting all about? To try to cut a deal. The Jews will pay, or will arrange for the conclusion of Turkish indebtedness to the European colonial powers in exchange for some concession of rights in Eretz Yisrael. There was like a 30 million franc debt that the Turkish owed to the British and French, to the creditors, and the Jews would somehow figure this all out for them and get a political concession in return. Now the problem with this, of course, is Herzl doesn't have the money. He's bluffing. So even if they say yes, what's he going to do? He never really figured that out because it never came to it. There never was a deal. But he meets the Sultan. He's given some kind of a low-level knighthood in the Ottoman Empire and is told, well, you can have an arrangement with us if you do this as financial favor, but two things. One, all the Jews who move in have to become Ottoman citizens subject to conscription in the Ottoman army. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's actually a bit of a neutral thing. It's potentially bad if there's a war and you don't want to fight and die, but it's better to be an Ottoman citizen than to not be an Ottoman citizen. And in the First World War, what happened to the Jews of Palestine who were not Ottoman citizens? They were shipped out. They went to Egypt. They went to Alexandria. They were exiled. Some of them came here, including David Ben-Gurion, came here.
And a few others.
Yeah, yeah. So
Trotsky was here.
Yeah. They all gathered at the New York Public Library with Eliezer Ben Yehuda too. So that's one condition. Ottoman citizenship and subject to conscription. The other is that Jews can come as individuals, but not in large groups, and not to Palestine. In other words, other places in the Ottoman realm, free flow of immigration, but not to be overly concentrated. So is this a solution to the Jewish problem? Not really. So this is not a good deal. Herzl goes home, not especially happy. In 1902, he's called back to Constantinople, and he thought he was going to get another meeting with the Sultan. He doesn't get that meeting, but he meets with the high-ranking underlings, and they offer a deal, now for Eretz Yisrael, some immigration rights, but no sovereignty, no autonomy, nothing like that, just the right of free flow of immigration, in return for very, very favorable terms to Turkey on their debt. Herzl sort of knew, and he figured it out immediately after the fact, that this was not a real offer. That the Sultan was just using the Jews as a foil to a French banker who was also proposing some other reconsolidation terms on Turkish debt. And in the end, the deal was cut with the French banker, not with the Jews. So they were just like, in a market situation, there's the phony buyer and the real buyer. Okay, so the Turkish are not really helpful, and Herzl recognizes a very important point, a critical factor. As long as the Ottoman Empire still exists, there will not be progress towards Jewish statehood in Eretz Israel. The Ottoman Empire will have to die, and it will die in World War I, before anything of that sort can happen. But... it doesn't mean that you stop trying to influence the other world powers in favor of Zionism. And it also might mean that other places aside from Eretz Yisrael might become necessary for the Zionists to focus on as a temporary solution to all the Jews' problems. So, but before we get to that, there's a little bit of an interlude. In late 1902, Herzl is called to London to testify before a parliamentary commission. About what? About the problem of Jews invading England. The Jews are coming in too fast and too furious from Russia. The truth of the matter is, they were coming in much greater numbers to New York. But all right, the Americans will have their time to complain in 1921, 1924 with the Johnson-Reed Act, restricting immigration. But the British beat them to the punch by two decades. In 1902, already, the British are contemplating dramatically restricting Jewish immigration to England. Because it's just too much. And what's the problem with Jews? Well, aside from general anti-Semitism, there's another factor. They're rabid socialists, a lot of these Jews. And England is a bit of a conservative, a stodgy old country with a monarchy. And they don't want to have rabble-rousing Trotskyites with a yarmulke or without a yarmulke on the east end of London. So they call Herzl to testify. Who's going to be against Herzl testifying at that commission? Who do you think?
Frumis.
Huh?
Frumis.
Why?
I would think because he probably might point the finger on them.
So not exactly. No. Those who opposed Herzl testifying were the establishment British Jews, notably Nathaniel Rothschild, who was a member of the House of Lords, because they were concerned that Herzl will say, there really is a Jewish problem. There's not only a Jewish question, there's a Jewish problem. And my solution is they all move to Palestine. So that's problematic twofold. Number one, the Rothschild types in London don't want anyone to admit that there's a Jewish problem. They'd rather people think that, oh, there's migration of people, and it's not so terrible, it's not so important, don't focus on it, let the flow keep coming. So they don't want to hear there's a problem. And number two, they don't want people to hear that the solution is in Palestine, because that casts aspersion on the loyalties of Jews everywhere in the diaspora. And it also will result in the passage of this law, a restrictive law on Jewish rights, on the rights of Jews to move in and about the country. So they don't want Herzl to testify. Well, What happened? They got lucky. Herzl's father died, and he had to go back to Vienna for the funeral. Herzl buried his father in the local cemetery, and he didn't buy a plot for himself. Why not? Because he doesn't think he's going to need it. He thinks he's going to be buried on Haraz 18 or wherever in Yerushalayim in the days of a Jewish state.
That's what happened.
Well, not exactly, but almost. You know. So a year later, when he's in a miserable strait, so the end of 1902, beginning of 1903, then he buys a plot for himself when he despairs that Zionism will be a success and he knows that he's going to die in Chutz La'aretz. Yes, he knew it was coming. He was very sick.
What was he sick from?
A heart ailment. He had several heart attacks. Several. Okay.
So all of these travels,
yeah,
with Kaisers and Sultans, is he solitary or does he have...
He has an entourage. He has people in Vienna who are part of the executive committee whose names are not memorable to your average Zionist Jew of today, who you'll never have heard of. His successor and one of his better lieutenants was David Wolfson, who you might have heard of, who was a Jew from Cologne and was in charge of the movement until 1911. But really, the people who he dealt with were not famous in the long run. Weizmann, who was a young kid at the time, becomes a big figure and is now known to all the Jews. But in 1897, 98, 99, 1900, you really don't have figures of lasting prominence. Okay. Well, in the early 1903, Herzl has an idea. Let's get the British to be supportive of Zionism. After all, there's a lot of philo-Semites there. There are members of government who have expressed pro-Zionist sympathies. The Jewish community has not the moneyed elite, but the rank and file have shown to be supportive of Zionism. So let's see what we can do with the British. And we'll get a territory that's adjacent to Eretz Yisrael to be a springboard for an eventual, not conquest of Palestine, but a jumping off point to go into Palestine. And where is that? In the Sinai. El Arish. So the northern coast of the Sinai Peninsula. That's Herzl's next brilliant scheme. Why does this have a chance of success? Well, his thinking is the British are in control of Egypt. The British like us. They're amenable to these sorts of things. And they can make it happen. And we don't need the cooperation of the Ottomans. Truth be told, who was sovereign in Egypt in 1903? The Ottomans. It's a very tricky situation. Ever since the 1840s, Ottoman control over Egypt had been in name only, but still in name. And the Egyptians ran their own affairs for a while, but the British took over effectively in the early 1880s. So the problem with this El Arish plan is that it would require the British, who don't really have sovereignty, to give a concession to the Jews in a country where indigenous Egyptians lived in, but where the Ottomans really are in control. So there's four different entities in this mix, in this pot, and it doesn't work. Too many ingredients in the broth. The Jews, the Egyptians, the British, and the Turks. Too much. That's going to be a problem. But Herzl doesn't want to see that problem at first. He says, oh, this is a brilliant idea. So he speaks to Lord Chamberlain, Joseph Chamberlain, who, not Neville Chamberlain, but Joseph Chamberlain, important distinction, yeah. And Chamberlain says, I can't help you because I am the colonial secretary and Egypt is not a colony. You'd have to speak to the Foreign Office. And the Foreign Office has a representative in Egypt, Lord Croner. Lord Croner is the boss. He's the man you got to speak to in Egypt. Okay, so Herzl goes there. Another trip to the Middle East. And they're going to have an expedition to scout out whether El Arish is a viable option for a Jewish settlement. Now, what do you think there's a problem? What's the problem with El Arish?
Water.
Bingo. There's no water. And nobody lives there for a reason. It's a desert. So, this expedition comes back with a not-so-favorable report. Insufficient amount of water. Herzl has an idea. We'll pump it from the Nile. Well, how much can you pump from the Nile? The Egyptians themselves need water, and they always have problems, so you can't siphon off too much. Moreover, you couldn't build the tunnel, the pipeline, because it would disrupt shipping in the Suez Canal for too long a period of time to do construction. So it's not a viable option. All right. So this is why El Arish failed. Now, the other British option was Cyprus, and that really was a British colony, but the colonial office said, listen, it's not going to work out. Very simply, the Cypriots live there, the Greek Cypriots, the Turkish Cypriots live there. They don't like each other, Muslims and Christians. To inject the Jews into the equation, it's going to be too crowded. So instead, the Jews got there in the barbed wire under British guns in 1945 through 48. But that's the end of that idea. So where does this leave us? Nowhere. There are no solutions to the Jewish problem. But the problem is getting worse. What happens in April of 1903 in Russia?
Kishinev
pogrom. The Kishinev pogrom was much bloodier than the ones of 1881, 1882. Those were a shock to the system, but that was mostly damage, not loss of life. In Kishinev, 60 people got killed in one town. In addition to hundreds and hundreds of rapes and men were castrated, it was horrible. Horrible. And the world knew about it because of press coverage and because Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote a very famous ode to the story of Kishinev. So, if the Jews need a solution to their problem, then you have to create one, even if it isn't very Zionistic. So what is that? Uganda. Now, truth is, it's not really Uganda, it's actually Kenya, by today's geography, but it was called Uganda, or British East Africa. Who came up with this idea? Well, the British came up with the idea, actually, but for them it was, again, a passing fancy. Herzl didn't know that at the time. He thought this was a very serious option, but it turned out to be nothing from nothing. But in the moment, it was a big deal. So he's in favor of it because, although it's not Zion, and our heart is in Zion, we need a Nacht Asyl, a night asylum, an emergency temporary provisional measure to save people who need to be saved. And it's bad in Russia, it's bad in Romania, there's pogroms in Romania too. People need to get out. Truth, in my estimation, Herzl was being a little bit disingenuous here, because there is a solution to the Jewish problem if the issue is pogrom, and that is the Lower East Side. Meaning, individuals can move whenever they want to get out of Russia, you just need boat passage. When he says we need a solution to the Jewish problem, he means a collective solution, because the Zionist or the Jewish nationalist in him does not want to see hundreds of thousands or millions of Jews leave Eastern Europe as individuals and go their separate way or go to the United States. He wants a collective solution to the Jewish crisis. And so if that's going to be in East Africa, so be it. Well, is this going to go over well with the real hardcore Zionists? No. The Zionist Zionists are not going to be in favor. The political Zionists will say it's a good idea. And at the Sixth Zionist Congress, we're going to discuss in a moment, this is a big fight, a big machlekes. And the whole thing almost collapses as a result of this fight. Before we can get to that, something else Herzl does before the Sixth Zionist Congress that gets him into a heap of trouble. And that is his dealings with the Russians. Herzl had always wanted a meeting with the Tsar, and he had never been able to get one, and he never did get one. But he, through his various contacts, he was invited to St. Petersburg and was able to meet with the Russian Minister of the Interior, von Pleve, and the Russian Finance Minister, Witt, and a few other figures. The problem is von Pleve was considered the architect of the Kishinev pogrom. So that's like Herzl going and shaking hands with Adolf Eichmann. It's Lahavdil. But maybe not Lahavdil. You know, the guy was bad. The guy said, other countries are complaining about what we're doing to our Jews, but they don't have the problem that we have. We have 136 million Russians and 7 million Jews. No other country has that. He says, if we could drown them all, I would have drowned them all. But since we can't do that, we have to find a way to let them live or let them leave. Now, who speaks like that? Only a vicious anti-Semite. So Herzl was going to take a lot of heat, a lot of flack, for meeting with the worst of the worst Tsarist officials who had their hands dirty with killing the Jews. But he said, we got to do this. He wants to cut a deal with the Russians. What's the deal? Well, The Zionists want three things from the Russian administration. One, the Tsar has to talk to the Sultan, mano a mano. It's got to be face to face. It can't be through an underling, through a foreign minister, through this. No, the Tsar himself and the Sultan in the same room with direct contact. Why? Because if it's anything less than that, the message won't get across. Because the Sultan either won't hear it because his deputies are all taking bribery and pocketing the money and not advancing the message, or because it won't be seen as serious if it comes from a foreign minister. It has to come from a head of state. So, Tsar to Sultan, speak in favor of Zionism and tell the Sultan to give a concession to the Jews in Palestine. Number two, there needs to be an incentive for the Jews to leave Russia. That Russia, the state, must provide incentives for the Jews to leave and to go to their national homeland. To which von Pleve said, don't we give them enough incentives by kicking them in the behind? Right, so Herzl says, so his response was, I know you've given us a lot of negative incentives. We want a positive incentive. What's the positive incentive? That the tax revenue that was collected from the Jewish community, which was an onerous tax that was unfairly assessed on Jews only, should then be used to give financial compensation for those who are going to leave to go to the national homeland. So some kind of kesef inducement to go to Palestine. The third thing is, Zionism should be legal in Russia. That up until then, it really wasn't. In 1891, the Chibat Tzion had secured for themselves a legal status for a charitable organization to support farmers in Palestine and Syria. But that was just a charitable organization. As a political organization, Zionism was never legal. So make it legal. Those are the three demands. Well, okay. So what does the Russian state want from Herzl to make this deal possible? Because they say yes to two out of these three, really all three of these things in theory. Well, number one, the Russian quid pro quo, not the Ukrainian quid pro quo, the Russian quid pro quo. If we give you this, you have to go back to the European newspapers and downplay the severity of the Kishinev pogrom. Whoa. Wow. Fake news. So the truth of the matter is, this was not the first time that Herzl had been approached about fudging the facts of world affairs. The Sultan in 1901 had said, you got to go to the European papers and downplay the significance of our actions against the Armenians. Also, big woe. So again, two times in Herzl's brief political career that his status as a journalist and the assumption that he held sway over European newspapers to make it seem as though atrocities were not that bad. Okay. So that's one thing. No. So the other thing that the Russians want Herzl to stamp out cultural Zionism. The Russians had spies everywhere, and they knew the latest and greatest about what was happening in the Zionist movement. The Russians have no problem with Herzlian Zionism, because Herzlian Zionism is take the Jews out of the diaspora and put them 1,000 miles away in Palestine. They could go for that. That's fine. But Achad HaAmism, cultural Zionism, believes in what? The survival of the diaspora, with a center in Eretz Israel spreading light into the diaspora, but basically the bulk of Jewry staying where they are and being nationalists in the Chutz La'aretz, meaning speak Hebrew, read Hebrew literature, be an avowed Jewish national as opposed to Russian national. That's very bad from a Tsarist perspective, because it turns the Jewish population of Russia into a really foreign element. They're already a foreign element, but it guarantees that they won't be Russified. And if what the Russians wanted above all was for those Jews who are going to remain behind, let them be Russified. Achad HaAm is the polar opposite of that. So stamp out cultural Zionism, only allow for political Zionism. That's what the Russians want from Herzl. That's a tall order, because remember, Zionism is a democratic movement, and it's going to have various factions, and each faction is going to want to have its own say over the future of the movement. Herzl can't easily stamp it out, and he really doesn't in the end. In fact, if anything, by 1902 he recognizes the need for cultural Zionism. Okay, so 1903, the Congress meets, the Sixth Congress. It'll be Herzl's last. He doesn't know it then, but he doesn't survive to the next one. Big fight between those who support Uganda and those who were against Uganda. In truth, even those who were supporting Uganda were not really supporting the idea of going to Uganda. They were just voting on the proposal to send a fact-finding mission to see whether this was a reasonable option. And even that caused the opponents to cry foul, as though they are those in favor of it are traitors and committing treason and are anti-Jewish, all sorts of invective heaped against them. By the way, it got so bad that in Paris, Max Nordau, Herzl's deputy, was shot at by a disgruntled Eastern European Jew who said, "You're a traitor for supporting Uganda." As it turned out, Nordau didn't even like the Uganda idea. He only went along with it just because he was of his loyalty to Herzl. And someone shot him for it. Thank God he missed. Nordau lived another 18 years, dies in 1921. I don't know what happened to the kid who shot him. I didn't look that up, though. I wonder what happened to him. So Herzl is caught between these various factions. He wins the vote, 275 to 178 with 93 abstentions. But it's a lot of abstentions, yet still he had a majority, an absolute majority of the votes. But it was a Pyrrhic victory because the movement was torn asunder. The Russian caucus left the room and stayed out for a few hours and had their cabal. They were talking, what are they going to do? In the end, they all came back. But with a wagging of the finger like, you've done wrong, Herzl. Herzl has to end the meeting by using a Hebrew expression, which he hardly ever used. Imeshkachech Yerushalayim tishkach imini. In Hebrew, he said it. Now, he didn't really know Hebrew, but he knew that line. And he knew that he had to say that line because of what he had just done. He had taken a chance, he'd gone out on a limb to support the Uganda idea, now he has to come back and say, no, I'm a real Zionist. I'm a Zionist Zionist. Okay. Now, as it turned out, the British retracted the offer. Why? So, interestingly, there were complaints from white British colonists in East Africa, who were only a handful of people at that time. It was mostly a black population. But the white colonists said, we got here first. We don't want to be inundated with Jews. Who wants Jews? So that was one reason why it failed. The other is just because the British lost interest. Again, Zionism is not at the top of the list of international priorities. It's getting there. Okay, the heads of state are talking about it, but it can lose momentum and ideas can fizzle out, Uganda being one of them. Okay, so one thing I left out was before the Sixth Congress, Herzl finally met the Ostjuden. Remember, Herzl is a Western Jew. Herzl, although he's from Hungary in Budapest, he thinks of himself as a cosmopolitan man of the West, Austria, Germany, France, that's where he's comfortable. And he doesn't know the old world Jews. He doesn't know them. After he goes to Moscow to see the Minister of the Interior and to negotiate these deals with the Tsarist government, he takes the train home. And on his way home, he stops in Vilna, his one and only time in a real Jewish, Ashkenazic, you know, real Jewish city. And he sees the Zionists and the Bundists and the Orthodox, everybody, huge crowds waiting to get to see him at the railroad stop. The police have to beat people with batons to keep the crowd in order. But tens of thousands of people in Vilna want to see Herzl, Melech Yisrael. Herzl, Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayim.
He obviously had some good PR.
Oh, tremendous PR.
Way, you know.
Yeah. So while he was in Vilna, so he went to dinner that night in some rich Zionist's home, which is half an hour's ride out of town. And while he was there, people knocked on the door. Herzl, we want to see you. One not so famous person met Herzl at that time. David Ben-Gurion's father, who requested from Herzl that the Zionist movement give a few shekels that his son can get an education. And Herzl like dismissed them, with a wave of the hand.
Victor Green.
Papa Ben-Gurion met Herzl for like 2 seconds and got shoved aside. And Ben-Gurion went on to become Ben-Gurion. All right. The influence of that Vilna gathering on Herzl's psyche was that he finally understood what the masses were all about. That the people who lived in the East had a Jewish neshama and a Jewish spirit and a Jewish heart and Jewish yearnings, the likes of which the Jews of the West just don't have. And that because there were so many of them, there'd be an army of masses to make Zionism successful, if and when a diplomatic breakthrough could finally be reached. Okay, so in a time of great despair for him, seeing the R-student and seeing how they revered him lifted his spirits when he needed his spirits lifted. Sometimes you need that to get you out of the doldrums. Okay. Well, the last year of Herzl's life, 1903-1904, he's still looking for European supporters of Zionism. He turns to the Italian peninsula, and he goes to the King of Italy. King of Italy is very supportive of the idea. He likes the idea of Zionism. Although, interestingly, he says, my support of Zionism will be different from those of the other European heads of state. In that, those other European heads of state who have expressed favorable sentiment do so to get rid of their Jews. Whereas I have fully emancipated Jews who are integrated. I mean, Italian Jewry was, they were more Italian than they were Jewish. And it's out of the goodness of my heart that I favor Zionism, not because I have an agenda with my population. It was a fair assessment of what was going on. But, he says, I can't do anything for you because it's a constitutional monarchy, and if you want to know what foreign policy is for this country, you've got to go to the government and the foreign minister, not the king. The king is basically a ceremonial figure. And again, he was right about that. There was very, very little Victor Emmanuel could do for a Zionist cause other than give him entree into to the Italian foreign minister. Then he goes to the Vatican, to the Holy See. Herzl had long wanted a meeting with the Pope and couldn't get one. But finally, the Pope is ready to see him. The attitude of the church was that the Jews are not a recognizable nation. They don't recognize Jesus, so we can't recognize the Jews. We cannot. Simple. We cannot. Okay. So they don't believe in any of that. That's not their theology. That's a Protestant theology. So Herzl says, well, what about all the suffering of the Jews all these years that the church has imposed upon us? And that we need to have a place on earth where we can call our own in order that we should not suffer from persecution anymore. To which the Pope's response was, the persecution wasn't that bad. And why do you have to go to Palestine? The church cannot acquiesce in a Jewish takeover of the holy places. Holy places. So Herzl says, I have a solution for that. We'll have extraterritorial status for the holy places. We're not going to have sovereignty over the church of the Holy Sepulchre, of the Temple Mount, but all that stuff is going to be extraterritorialized, internationalized. We'll just have Palestine, the mundane earth of Palestine. To which the Pope responds, even that no good, pick somewhere else in the world. So the Pope is not cooperative at all, for theological reasons and probably just base anti-Semitism. That would remain the attitude of the church for a long time. So, in 1964, Pope Paul VI went to Israel, and he went to Israel without going to Israel.
He didn't go through the border.
So he went through Jordan, and his only stop in Israel was in Megiddo, where he reluctantly met some Israeli dignitaries, but he would not go to the government complex in Yerushalayim because he didn't recognize the existence of the state of Israel. So John Paul, in 1993, signs the Concordat with the state of Israel, which was negotiated in large measure, not even by Israeli diplomats, but by elements of the chief rabbinate. Shaya Shivkon had a strong hand to play in Israel Meir Lau in talking with the clergy people to make that happen. And so finally you had a deal between Israel and the Holy See. But for a long, long time, their opposition was just as fierce as it was in the days of Theodor Herzl. Okay. So, life isn't good for Herzl. It's early 1904. The Uganda proposal is on its last legs. None of the major world powers have really come forward with any positive solution. The Ottomans are as entrenched as ever, not willing to budge, and Herzl is deathly ill. He dies July 3rd, 1904, and his funeral is attended by 10,000 people. Wow. Those who, in his lifetime, were dismissive of him, recognized in his death that he was something, a lot more than they had given him credit for, that he was a visionary who saw into the future. But who's to say that what he saw would ever come to pass? So in 1904, this is very far from actualizing itself. His wishes were that his body would be buried in Vienna, in the vault there with his family, until such time as a Jewish government would move his remains to Eretz Yisrael. And in 1949, the body is moved to Har Herzl. Okay. He was buried in a metal coffin. This way, the transfer of the remains would be a lot easier. Had he been buried in a wood box, after 50 years, it would be decomposed, there'd be nothing left, it wouldn't be pretty. So the nature of the burial was such that it was easy to move the remains in 1949. Now, with this, I'll close. Herzl was a dreamer, and he was overly focused on securing for the Jews international recognition of the legitimacy of their national movement. And he was right to think about that, and nobody else had done so before him. But his blind spot, and he had a few blind spots, was he didn't realize the importance of the work on the ground in Eretz Yisrael. That because Zionism was going to face obstacles in the Holy Land, building up the Yishuv was going to be much more important than diplomacy in the long run. That's where the likes of Ben-Gurion, a generation later, understood what Herzl couldn't understand. The other is, Herzl was blind to the idea of Arab opposition to Zionism. He figured they would blend into the scenery. Was there anyone talking in Herzl's day, 1897 to 1904, of the Arab question? The answer is yes. The Jews were not totally oblivious to the Arab problem. It's just that those were isolated voices who weren't being taken seriously just yet because the problem had not become acute. When would the problem of the Arabs become acute? In 1920, when you first have real riots and killing in Yerushalayim, when Jabotinsky starts raising a tumult. So Herzl did not foresee many of the problems, but he had an important vision that nobody else had. Now, one last thing, actually. In 1902, he wrote a novel, Alt New Land, which means Old New Land. And we don't have time, because it's already 9:15, to get into the plot line, but I'll regal achas on one foot. It's about a Jew who is depressed and takes up responds to an ad in a newspaper from some goy who wants to go off the grid and basically go to a Pacific island and never be heard from again. Like your life is a misery and you want to go off into to the yonder and never be heard from again and cut yourself off from the world. So they do that, but before they go, they make one last stop off in Palestine, 1902. And it's backward, and it's filthy, and just Arab fellaheen, and a handful of Jews, and they're Orthodox, and there's hardly any real modern life. And they go off to the Pacific Island, and in 1923 they decide, you know what, we've had enough of being on a Pacific Island, we're going to come back. and they go back through the Suez Canal, they come to Palestine. And what is Palestine? They have cars and telegram and telephone and electricity and a hydroelectric dam and futuristic times. Now, remember, futuristic by the standards of 1902, what they thought 1923 would look like, not what they thought 2000 would look like. But again, it's futuristic, and it's not capitalist, it's not communist, it's mutual aid society, it's a democracy. All the good things, a wonderful utopia was created in 20 years, courtesy of Zionism. For Herzl, he thought that that was possible, that Israel was going to be this wonderful place, or Lagoim, in peace, even without an army. He never fathomed that Israel would be born in war, and for 70 years would be a garrison state fighting for its life in a hostile neighborhood. That was not part of the Zionist agenda for the first decade or so of its existence. So we'll have to, in future weeks, examine when does the Zionist movement realize that even if they create a state, it's going to be a garrison state always at war. To be continued.